Okay, I think we should start. Good evening. Welcome, everyone. My name is Mary Frances McMullen. I'm president of the Ulster Medical Society, and I'm delighted that we're here tonight for the Colonel Desmond White Memorial Lecture, which happens every year as part of the Ulster Medical Society program in Athmagelvin. It was specifically, as far as I can gather, set up for that purpose. So Colonel White, I found out about, a very interesting person, and I'm sure there's many people in the room knew him. My colleague who worked here over many years, Robert Cuthbert, informs me that he was Mr. Athmagelvin right from the beginning. However, when you look up about him, he actually had an extremely interesting war record. He was in the second Chinda expedition in 1944. He got the DSO, but everybody that I read said he really should have had the VC, but he didn't care. He then trained as a radiologist and came here in 1957, so he was here in the hospital from the beginning and was very active. Many people, even when we were talking tonight, remember being taught radiology by him. It's also very interesting because I'd heard of this guy before, because I know his hematological diagnosis, which he did not die of but died with the year before the wonder cure for that disease appeared. And he's always quoted as somebody who lived for many, many years with the disease without having to wait for the wonder cure and didn't do him any harm. So it's quite interesting coming back. However, this is the Desmond White Memorial Lecture, and I'm delighted tonight to have Professor Manuel Salto Talpes, who has agreed to give this lecture. Now, Professor Talpes is the Chair of Molecular Pathology in Queen's University Belfast, I think, probably for the last 8 years, and also Consultant Pathologist and leads Queen's Precision Medicine Centre of Excellence. He actually trained in Spain, Germany and the Netherlands, and then in histopathology in the UK and molecular pathology in the US. He worked in Singapore for many years and then luckily came to Queen's, and he's now a leading light in molecular pathology, obviously in Queen's, but much wider than that with the college and in general. He has many publications and over 275 publications and a large grant income. So the theme I had for this year was diagnostics in the future, and trying to look to see where things are going with diagnostics, which I think is if you make the diagnosis, then you go on and that in medicine. And that's why I wanted to ask Professor Talpes, and he luckily agreed immediately, and he's going to talk about the promise and reality of precision medicine in Northern Ireland. So, Manuel, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for the kind invitation and the kind introduction. So my task today is to pontificate about personalized medicine. And as you, or some of you know me, know very well that pontificating is the passion of my life. So I really like it. So hopefully this will be relatively easy. My task is personalized medicine, and I'm going to try to do this in four bits. Tell you a little bit of what I think are the global challenges today that we have in medicine, which also affect to Northern Ireland. Tell you a little bit about the program that we developed over the last couple of years. Tell you where I think things are going in this space, and then hopefully we will try to read where the future may bring us. Before that, though, I would like to really congratulate Mary Frances for this program. If you exclude my lecture, this is probably the best program that we have seen in personalized medicine in Northern Ireland that I can remember. And the fact that people of this caliber have agreed to come within a space of 1 year and talk says very much about the person that has organized this program. So really, congratulations. It's a very special program. So global challenges. You know, when I was a medical student, I really wanted to live exciting times, and that was what I was hoping for. When you start working across the world, you realize that interesting times may mean different things for different people. Sometimes it's a positive, sometimes it's a negative. Positive or negative, I think there is no question that we are living in very interesting times. We know, for instance, and the Bengoa report and other reports have reminded us in Northern Ireland, that it's going to be very difficult to sustain practicing medicine the way we are doing it today, and that we may have to revisit the way we organize ourselves. We have a very clear distinction of what is research and what is diagnostics. And yet that distinction is getting more and more blurred as we move forward. For instance, the oncologists in the audience know that the number and the quality of the patients that you put in clinical trials is not only a research activity, it's also in many ways a measure of quality of healthcare. At the same time, we know that if you are delivering molecular diagnostics in a laboratory that is also involved in research and development, you probably have earlier access to technology, earlier access to know-how, and probably your end product is going to be better. You know, we have a lot of hope in translational research. We think that linking basic discoveries with clinical applications is the gold standard. And yet, we have to say that we are doing translational medicine in general very badly. For every 100 papers that are out there claiming that there is a finding that is translatable into clinical applicability, less than 1% make their way into that application. And together with my colleague Richard Kennedy, we try to understand why. And we came with these filters of reality. If you take into account those biomarkers that we don't know much to start with, those that were developed with technology that was suboptimal, those that were developed in studies that were not designed properly from a clinical point of view, or those that were validated and developed in an assay in a suboptimal way, then you can really explain why we have this attrition rate, which is not small. We have a conundrum, as you know, in drug development. You don't have to go to developing countries. We know that the cost of providing a drug that is ready to use for patients is extraordinary, and it's because of the way we organize our clinical trials. And there is a very clear need to try to revisit how we do this in a way to make all this process more manageable, at the same time maintaining the quality of what we do. We have a lot of hope in personalized medicine, and to be fair, it's working. There are patients that are living longer lives, are living better lives because of personalized medicine. The problem that we have is that with the current paradigms, many of these patients come back with disease that is molecularly very aggressive and is more difficult to treat. And what we are doing is essentially buying months, perhaps 1 or 2 years of life to these patients. And in fact, the other issue is that imagine that you live in the best possible scenario, in a hospital that has all molecular tests and have access to all potential clinical trials available for those patients. It's likely that still the vast majority of your patients will not enjoy personalized medicine because we still don't have the target for the drug for those targets. Now, you can compare that with the new kid on the block, immune checkpoint therapy, where for some cases, in some diseases and some patients, we are seeing long, sustainable survivals that we've never seen before, outside the hematology field, of course. But then, we know that this is happening only in a percentage of patients, and we still don't know why. And then we have another problem. The UK is arguably the largest producer of research, high-quality research in the world. It's second to none in other parts of the world. And yet, when we look at the venture capital that is behind those ideas to make them available into potential patient use, we know that we are not very well there and that we need to change that, and we need to change that practice. So all this was in our minds when 8 years ago we came to Northern Ireland to develop a molecular pathology program. How can we address all this, and how can we do this from a small place in the periphery of Europe, in the periphery of the UK, in the periphery of the periphery? And so we thought that probably the best way would be to have a model that we challenge some of these questions. And that's where we came with a very specific a precision medicine program or molecular pathology program. The word here was integration. There are going to be many parts of the world that are going to tell you that they have a very good biobank, that they do wonderful immunohistochemistry, that they're great in molecular studies, that they are very good in digital pathology or in bioinformatics, but a place under a single roof where you can develop this with the quality that we know and is appropriate for clinical patients, but also being used for research, that didn't exist. And that was our task. If I tell you that there are people in my university that still don't understand this concept, don't be surprised. It's not easy. Just like some people in the trust think that why are we doing tests in what is perceived as a research laboratory, although I can assure you is Belfast Trust space. Well, that is what we wanted to do. 8 years down the road, we've developed a program where we have very interesting molecular diagnostics going on, and I'll tell you a little bit more about how it's going to be developed, because it's key to personalized medicine in Northern Ireland. We have research programs in genomics and in digital pathology and artificial intelligence. We have a very strong education program with a very strong MSc in cancer. We have developed a very strong Northern Ireland biobank, my colleague Jackie James, that underpins much of the research that we do. And we have developed a precision medicine center of excellence, which I would like to explain to you later on what that means. Overall, we've managed to amalgamate 60 people with significant traction. Now, this is where we are. So we do molecular pathology, we do precision medicine. But what is that, really? To be honest, there are as many definitions as people have tried to define this concept. And in fact, we use a different definition depending to which grand call we attend, because we want the money. But in any case, there's probably two ways of understanding this. You can define molecular pathology as the interrogation of clinical samples to understand better the nature of those diseases. Those would be translational research. And you know the model of these papers. You've seen them many times. We take clinical samples, well-annotated clinical samples. We do morphological studies. We interrogate them from a molecular point of view. We see how our results correlate with clinical outcomes, and those are our results. This is molecular pathology so widely known that most of these studies are not done by molecular pathologists anymore. Many of them are done by very good clinicians. Now, you can think of molecular pathology essentially as an application of those disease mechanisms for diagnosing to prognostication or treatment of diseases. Then we are talking about molecular diagnostics. And as you know, many areas of medicine are already fully embedded in molecular diagnostics. Virology is probably 100% molecular. Hematology, very much the same. Genetics, I don't have to tell you. What I'm talking about today is probably the application of molecular diagnostics to histopathology or to cytopathology. That is the area where we are moving. And that's why we developed this clinical service. So, why a clinical service in precision medicine? Well, let me give you an example. In 2012, I was asked to review the best examples that we had of precision medicine, i.e., of antibodies and small molecule inhibitors targeting very specific known genes and pathways to essentially treat all diseases with new ways. I counted 16. 2 years later, in 2014, a colleague of mine did a similar exercise, and the number have gone up to 32. And just last year, when I joined one of the NICE groups to discuss management of colorectal cancer, I looked at the NICE list, and the list I didn't bother to count. So obviously, this is a model that is here to stay. The model that you have drugs that can specifically target a specific molecular pathways, and we know how they are operating. So the molecular diagnostics today is a commissioned molecular diagnostic service for the whole of Northern Ireland. These are the people that are working on it today. We are doing many of the bread and butter tests in solid tumors. By hopefully middle of next year, we are going to start developing next generation sequencing for many of our hematological malignancies and solid tumors. In fact, the molecular hemato-oncology service will be amalgamated with this as well. And obviously, we are, as Mary Frances kindly told us earlier on, very much in many of the national initiatives. Just to avoid you taking you through all those tests, allow me to give you an example. What are we doing, for instance, for lung cancer in Northern Ireland today? So for lung cancer, we do reflex testing for every non-small cell lung cancer for PD-L1 testing. For adenocarcinoma, we add EGFR mutations and ALK. ROS is available on request. We have finished the validation. And also upon request, we can look at EGFR mutations in the peripheral blood. We do EGFR testing. As you know, EGFR is a very prominent member of a very prominent family of transmembrane proteins. We know that many of these mutations confer sensitivity to to tyrosine kinase inhibitors. Some of them confer resistance. And in fact, when I try to explain our students the basis of personalized medicine, probably one of these first trials, the IPAS trials, explain it better than anything else. EGFR patients that are EGFR mutant or wild type, if you give them chemotherapy, they are going to have a similar survival. If you give TKIs to patients that are EGFR mutant, you help them. It's again, as usual, the same curve. We are buying months, years of life, but the patients come back. But see what happens when we give TKIs to patients that are wild type. Not only we are not helping them, we are making them a disservice. Chemotherapy standard of care is better. That is the reason we are doing testing with many of these drugs. So far, we have done a significant number over the years, and our numbers, both in quality and delivery, are very much according to national standards. We can do this test in cell-free DNA. We were one of the first six laboratories in the UK doing this. The idea is that if you test for EGFR mutations, you can detect molecular recurrence after treatment, and you can also identify those mutations, like the T790M, that for which you already have third-line treatment. Interestingly, the use of this test, the most widely used of this test, is actually by oncologists when they see that their biopsy was not good enough to do an EGFR testing because there wasn't enough sample. Then it's easy to get a blood sample, and if the mutation is there, you know that you can treat accordingly. We do ALK testing. So ALK testing and crizotinib is a well-known story. In the US, the drug is associated with a test that is extremely expensive. In Europe, most of us have a screening tool, mostly immunohistochemistry, confirmed by fluorescent in situ hybridization. And in fact, our validation showed exactly the advantages of each of these tests and how they should come together to apply them as a whole. And again, our deliverable is very much according to national standards. And we were talking about this earlier on. We are doing PD-L1 testing. The reason, as you know, is also very clear. For some patients, stage 4 adenocarcinomas, for instance, we are seeing long sustainable survivals like we've never seen before. The idea here is that the tumor cells are silencing our immune system, and if you block that link between the tumor and the immune cell will be able to have its anti-carcinogenic effect. The stories are probably a little bit more complex than that, but yet PD-L1 seems to be the biomarker that, with all its imperfections, is working today in the clinic. In fact, we published early this year what I believe is the largest clinical series on PD-L1 testing, our first 700 or 800 patients. So here we started presenting what is the performance of the test in real life. And interestingly, we started exploring something else that is going to be part of my lecture later on. Can we use digital pathology and artificial intelligence to improve the delivery of personalized medicine? This early study told us that indeed that is possible, and that there is room for that. This lady, the chief medical officer, Sally Davis, has transformed the way molecular diagnostics is going to be practiced in England, that is currently being practiced in England. The idea is that there's going to be 20-odd genomic medical centers that are going to send all their clinical samples for testing to approximately 7 genetic hubs that already have been chosen, by the way, and that molecular information is going to go back to those genomic medical centers to start managing patients. This has been very controversial because obviously it's putting a long distance between tissue pathology services, genomic services, clinical services. I can tell you that the decision in Northern Ireland has been that the genetic hub is going to be our laboratory. So the commissioners are going to spend £10 million over the next 5 years to make sure that all the patients that need testing in cancer and in rare diseases are going to have it by next generation sequencing, which is an idea that we presented when we started this process 8 years ago. And I'm very happy that we are going to have a single virtual molecular pathology service to cater for all the needs. And the reason is obviously because through competitive funding, we've been able to create a laboratory with the capacity that to be able to do that from a technical point of view. So this will be the first the first panel, the solid tumor panel, that we will be using for this purpose. So this has been designed so that all the mutations, all the translocations, all the copy number variations that you need to treat solid tumors across the board, for which there is already NICE approved drugs, can be tested in one single test. Here you have the ideal paradigm of all the mutations that you should test in lung cancer, and I can tell you that all of them are present in this kit, and the same we could say with malignant melanoma, with colorectal cancer, with gastric cancer, with breast cancer, endometrial cancer, etc. And the reason this is happening is because I think the laboratory has shown that there is good quality behind. For instance, we joined a one study in lung cancer as well that is supposed to analyze cases from the whole of the UK to understand much better what is the molecular basis and the cancer evolution of this specific cancer type. For that, we've been receiving samples from many parts of Northern Ireland, and what we are told about the quality of the work that we have done is that it's certainly above the average of what has come through the UK. So there is a good quality in the service. Where are we going with this? Well, one of the good things of having been in the business for more than 20 years is that you begin to have a bit of an historical perspective. And it's very clear that since pathology became a clinical discipline at the middle of last century, probably, there's probably been three main revolutions in pathology. One came with the application of immunohistochemistry. So this was a tool that pathologists loved. We started throwing antibodies at everything. The taxonomy of many of our cancer types was totally transformed by this analysis. And pathologists did very well. So the idea that we could have a tool that will tell us about intensity of a protein, subcellular localization, lineage specificity, that transformed in many ways the way we started looking at cancer. The second one has come with the genomic revolution, a little bit later than the discovery of the helix. Very important, is helping many of our patients. We are changing complex pathology taxonomies where pathologists pontificate about if that cell means one thing or another, when often there wasn't any clinical relevance with those subclassifications, into classifications that are potentially more meaningful from a clinical point of view. The problem, as I tried to tell you earlier on, is that this is helping some of our patients very modestly, and it's not helping many of our patients at all. We need new tools. We need new tools that are going to help us to help our patients better. How do we do this? Well, I think that in a few years down the road, when we look back at these years, probably we are going to recognize a third revolution, which is the one that is coming with digital pathology and with artificial intelligence. The promise of artificial intelligence is phenomenal. If you open a medical journal today, you will be told that you can analyze genomics with artificial intelligence and make significantly more sense of it, that you can analyze radiological images and pathological images and get information that you never got before, that you can actually look at clinical records from patients and start having decisions that could be more accurate than the subjective decisions of the oncologists. Believe it or not. That you can actually take all this information to the web and start getting information about individual patients that is close to epidemiological information and can help you with the patient much better, or that you can take all that information and put it in a big population data and tell you significantly more information about that patient that is going to tell you how to treat the patient better. All this is obviously a promise, but it's a promise that is becoming a must. And how much of this we are going to be able to deliver at the end of the day, I think is a very big question. But it's interesting to think that of all these potential uses, the uses associated with pathology are probably the ones, together with radiology, that are more advanced. We know, for instance, today, that if I come to work in my pathology department, and instead of switching on the microscope, I switch on my computer, and I look at the pathology images that have been scanned, instead of looking through the microscope, the clinical result, if I am well trained, is going to be the same. There are already two studies which have proven to FDA that there is no inferiority by doing it that way. We know that this process can help pathology much better. Now, many of you may be associated with this, but let me refresh your memory. What happens when a sample comes to pathology? Usually formalin fixed, but we embed it, we cut it, we trim it, we produce an H&E manually or automated. That H&E may or may not be scanned, and in silico or in glass is presented to a pathologist, and in 50-60% of the cases, the pathologist is going to say, this is chronic gastritis, this is severe dysplasia, this is cancer. More often than not, we are going to do immunohistochemistry or in situ hybridization, usually in an automated fashion that you can scan or not, and that can lead you to a diagnosis. And more often than not these days, in 3,000 cases this year, we are going to take those samples, we are going to do annotations, we are going to extract the nucleic acids, and that is going to lead to a small panel testing for diagnosis or high-throughput analysis through bioinformatic curation into a clinical diagnosis. I don't know of any pathway in medicine that is as fragmented as this one. As the biochemist, as the microbiologist, they have seamless pathways. Here we are with every fragment of the piece in a different machine and in a different way. I think that digital pathology can help this process. For instance, what are we seeing now? This is a more basic version of what I've just presented to you. What do we know that digital pathology can do today? We know that we can apply algorithms, created, by the way, in Northern Ireland, that can tell us which area of the tumor to annotate with results that are comparable to what pathology is actually going into the system and marking that area. We know that we can score immunohistochemistry in a way that may be closer to the clinical outcome than the opinion that I may be giving on Monday morning or on Friday evening, which is likely to be different. We know that because we know that in the whole development of new drugs, there is a companion diagnostics that you can apply through digital pathology. We know that today artificial intelligence can detect very specific pathological features, for instance, micrometastasis in lymph nodes, perhaps more accurate than the human eye. And we know, surprise, surprise, that today, that by looking just at an H&E, you can start understanding what is the molecular basis of a disease. We know that with mutations in lung cancer, we do that by microsatellite instability, we know that, for instance, with HER2 in breast cancer. This is beginning to happen. And I'll tell you some of the work that we've done here just to illustrate that point. What is the elephant in the room when you want to apply a large next-generation sequencing panel? Well, that there is a lot attrition rate. And we have many examples in the UK telling us that quantity and quality of DNA is essential. We know, and my colleague David Gonzalez has shown this very elegantly, that there is a direct relation between amount of material that you have in your DNA extraction and the success of your DNA, of your next-generation sequencing. And we know, by the way, that pathologists are absolutely useless at indicating how much material there is in a cell, in a slide. There's been plenty of studies telling us that the variation is significant. We are good at many things. We are not so good at that. As I mentioned earlier on, we have developed a tool that is able to do this in a consistent manner. And this actually is a bit of a moment of pride, if you want, for Belfast, and I'll tell you why. This is a tool that we developed together with a local company, a spin-off from Queen's called PathXL. The tool was called TissueMark, which is one of these tools that did it from conceptualization to commercialization in less than 2 years. A large company, Philips, liked TissueMark, therefore liked PathXL. Philips bought PathXL. TissueMark is now one of our star products. Philips has invested 3 times in the development of the Belfast unit, so much that it's probably one of the highest hubs for digital pathology today in Europe, and this is a tool that is used, for instance, in UK NICUAS in some of their schemes. So it seems to work. In fact, if you look at one of those products today and you ask them, tell me what is their cellularity, this is one of those cases that many of you are looking today from a clinical point of view. This is colorectal cancer, stage 4, lots of lymphocytes, poorly differentiated, MSI high, the ones that we think could be amenable to anti-PD-L1 therapy. This is what the tool is doing today, telling us exactly the vast majority of the tumor cells and differentiating them from other tumor types. In Belfast, in my laboratory, we developed QPath. Well, I didn't develop it. I created the program. It was developed by this gentleman, Pete Bankhead, who is probably one of the brightest minds I've ever worked with. He is now a senior lecturer in Edinburgh. Now, QPath is the most used tool in the world today for digital pathology analysis of tumors. More than 50,000 downloads, more than 200 citations, and I think it's very useful for 2 reasons. First of all, because we decided to do it open source. In other words, it's free, and people like that. But also because it's actually very accurate in the way we deliver it. For instance, we wanted to know that that tool could tell us clinically meaningful information. So we took a cohort of patients that we've been working on for years now in Northern Ireland, the EPI-700 colorectal cancer cohort that has been published in other sites before. We started looking at some of these biomarkers and the clinical relevance of how QPath was able to identify those biomarkers was very, very clear. So in the last ESMO, because this is so well known, I was asked to evaluate what has been the impact of QPath in oncology. Now, at the time, there had been, depending on where you look at, 94 citations, 172. This was September. We are now in close to 200 citations, as I mentioned earlier on. And as you can see, it's a tool that is used for diagnostics, as much as translational, as much as basic, and it has one of the highest citation indexes today in the field. Because it works. Because it's a very logical way of analyzing results. We applied it to breast cancer again, and even in biomarkers that we know are notoriously difficult, like Ki-67 scoring, the results were very, very good. In fact, one of the leads in this field, David Rim, actually decided to take 150 breast cancers, decide to detect Ki-67. He used, without us knowing about it, 2 off-the-shelf, pretty expensive kits and QPath, just downloaded for free. And the performance of QPath was remarkable. In fact, we are using that now in our lung cancers with a test that is extremely difficult, like PD-L1, together with multiplexing. And we think we are on the way of improving the way we are doing this test against a very subjective interpretation. So this is many of the things that we are doing today. And as you can see, I've broadened the discussion of personalized medicine from DNA-based and RNA-based tests to other tests that I think are also very, very meaningful. As I mentioned earlier on, we decided to have an integrated program. We thought that integration was meaningful. The result of that integration is beginning to pay in this area of the program. is the Precision Medicine Centre of Excellence. So this is an investment of £10 million, mostly from Invest Northern Ireland, that has already brought in a year £5 million to the local economy. And the way we argued our case was the following. We know, as I mentioned earlier on, that there is a lot of discovery going on in the UK. We know that there is a gap between those discoveries and industry taking those discoveries and making them into a proper diagnostic device. And then we know that once we have that diagnostic device, we need to show to universal healthcare systems like the NHS that those tools are cost efficient and they are worth using. So we thought that we could help in both areas, in bridging the space between discovery and industry, and in the adoption bit of doing those tests in the NHS. And for that, we managed to put a very interesting team. We were told that we wouldn't be able to recruit the level of talent that was necessary for something like that. I can tell you that while informatics team applied from Manchester, we were not very popular in Manchester for a while, I can tell you that. Matt came from Leeds, Manisha came from the Marsden, like David, Louise came from Cambridge, Liz came from Southampton, Jackie, Dara, Cathal came from Almack, Beryl and Perry are local talent. It really made a point, and the services now are in full blown. One of the things that we want to do is to try to understand where the future may bring us. And what I have told you are two different types of tests that are actually running in parallel. We think that these tests should come together, and that the information that we have from tissue hybridization and from genomics should try to help inform patients much better. And this is one of our main activities today. And one more thing, which I think is very relevant. Something that is very clear in the last 8 years. We are operating with 5 trusts, with 4 pathology departments, 2 cancer centers, 2 universities with a catching population of 1.9 million. We shouldn't be fragmented. There should be single programs, even if they are, which doesn't mean that they need to be in one single place. But we need single programs. We need every single patient in Northern Ireland helping in developing programs like this. Because I think only then we are going to be able to make the most of what we are doing. This is our building. I show this picture at night because during the day I can assure you it's a horrible building. It looks very, very bad. We are essentially in the ground floor and the first floor. These are some of the people that have done some of the studies that I've presented today. These are our external collaborations and the people that pay for our bills. And thank you very much for your attention.